Gordon Stanley on 12th August 1981 at the IRSI meeting in Washington, D.C. Well, could you tell me, before we get to radio astronomy itself, what your educational background was, and then how you first came into contact with radio astronomy?
Okay. Well, I think I told you this before, but I'll go over it again. And as I said to you before we started recording, you can... Some of my chronology of the earliest part is possibly incorrect because I wasn't that interested, but I'm sure you have plenty of cross-grained references.
Right.
You check. I'll tell you where I'm more certain of what happened.
Okay.
I came out of Sydney Technical College, like a lot of others at Radio Physics, with a degree in electrical engineering.
Mm-hmm.
And the first job at, well, I won't go into a lengthy discussion of why I went to radio physics, but it's sufficient to say that it was a rather bad emotional time for me, and it was something that stuck with me for about 5 years. It was the death of my mother that dragged on a long time, and things like that. It just happened that radio physics was close to home, and it made it easy. I had no particular conviction about going into radio or work, and certainly not into astronomy.
I see. So what year was this now?
We're talking just after the war. I'd come out of the army.
Mm-hmm.
This, I think it was, I went to radio physics in a March, and it must have been March of 1945.
That seemed before the end of the...
Just before the end of the war,
yes.
I was discharged.
And did you do any radar work during the war?
No, none. Okay. None at all. I was in the infantry.
In the infantry.
I had no connection with radio whatsoever.
Okay.
No ambition to be in a radio area. I hadn't even thought of it. I had ambitions to go back into heavy power engineering and do that sort of thing.
So
I was assigned to Garth Dewhurst, whose name is probably not important in radio astronomy. He was a very fine guy. And, he was a modulator designer at Radio Physics. Maybe I can... I'll say who was there, the people that you know, and who came after that time. Radio astronomy, as you probably know by now, really was started in a group called, I think, Group D, which was the receiver group in radio physics. Lindsay McCready was the head of that, and the people in the group were Russ Trahan, who did a little bit in radio astronomy. He was a very fine man.
What was his name again?
Russ Trahan.
Trahan.
His father was director of music in New South Wales schools and was well known. And he was a very fine man. Ruby Payne Scott.
Right.
Don Urquhart, who plays a part in radio astronomy. Ted McCarthy. I'll tell you a little bit about this.
You're telling me some names I've never heard before.
Well, this is the start. I'm telling you right at the start.
Yes, right.
The technicians in the group were Charlie Fryer. This is the receiver group, because this was the essential one. Charlie Fryer and Alec Little, to some extent, and I came in sort of just about on the same level as Alec Little. How I got into the group was that I said to you once, I remember in the last, this is what reminded me of our last conversation, I said, I'm a sort of an independent type. I don't regard that as a great virtue, really, but it's just a fault in my character.
More
than anything else, you said most people are like that, or most people say the same thing. It's not that I feel that I want that I had any particular credit for being independent.
Yeah.
I'm just built that way.
Yeah.
Well, anyhow, I went into the receiver group under the patronage, I suppose, of Lindsay McCready, who took... Lindsay, have you talked to Lindsay?
Oh, he's dead.
That's what I thought.
Yes.
It's unfortunate.
A long time ago.
I thought it's a pity. He had a lot of the keys to what went
on. Well, tell me something about him.
Lindsay was a very austere man. He was sort of a very hard to get near, terribly nervous man too, sort of uptight, shaped, dark, Scottish, very Scottish look about the man, rather on the thick, going on towards the thick set side. But he took a sort of, for reasons I didn't understand at the time, he sort of took a somewhat fatherly interest in me and put up with my ignorance and helped me over a number of humps.
Yeah, so what was his particular technical expertise?
Receivers. Mm-hmm. Receivers, as far as I know. I'm not even sure what his education was. I think he came out with a degree in engineering in Sydney.
And he had been at Radio Physics during the war, I assume.
He had been there at the war. Now, Frank Kerr, of course, was there, but he was not in that. He was doing super refraction work. Alec Little had been radio physics since he was a boy, practically. He'd come early in the war. Frank had come early in the war. Don Yabsley was there. Mm-hmm. He was not. He had some connection with the receiver group, but not a strong connection with the receiver group. Who else?
All these people I've talked to that you're naming.
Sure. Now. Well, they were all there. I'm just trying to get you, set the scene so it sets a framework for my attitudes as well, and it may help you to calibrate.
How do you relate Pawsey to MacCready? Was Pawsey MacCready's boss, or?
Pawsey was MacCready's boss. The boss of the lab when I came there was Jane Britton, who went back. They had all sorts of people. Britton was a good guy, but he went back to the Australian Tobacco Company, WD and Heritage Wills, I think, at the end of the war, and Taffy took over. But it wasn't clearly resolved. I mean, I think they would have offered the job to Joe, but Joe didn't want to be involved in that sort of administration. Mm-hmm. He sort of wanted to float around as a scientific type in the organization. And I think that sort of, I don't know the right word, but that sort of sloppiness in Joe, in a way, was the cause of the terrible, or part of the cause, anyhow, of the terrible eruption that occurred somewhat down the road. Anyhow, I was attached to Lindsay. And Lindsay sort of was a little easy about it. Although I said he's an austere man, he also didn't control people very well. And the first thing I did was a 200 megahertz radar, which I didn't know how to do, but I did it. And it worked, the little one which they were doing. I
think this has nothing to do with astronomy.
It was for super refraction work when they were flying off the coast. Now, I wasn't, being a very junior member of the group, I wasn't privy to what the decisions were, so I don't know anything about why they really decided to look at the sun. Mm-hmm. When I came into it, some of the observations of the sun, well, the basis for the observations of the sun were the reports from the radar observation. It was called the Norfolk Island effect at radio physics.
We
acknowledge the fact that they were in the secret files, their reports from English radar operators, that the same thing had happened. And I wasn't conscious of Bruce Lee's letter, which I heard of years after.
Which I was able actually to find in the archives 3 years ago.
Yeah, well, I was not conscious of that at that time, and Bruce didn't appear for some way down the line. The people who weren't there, who were important, of course, Paul wasn't there, John wasn't there, Chris wasn't there. And they came after a period when we thought people were going to be cut down. Well, anyhow, I was there at the crucial point of decision. I remember Taffy had a meeting and said, well, we've got to find other things to do. Radar's not out, but we're going to drop out on this. We've got to find other things. People suggested crazy things like that's going to TV and things like that. But anyhow, they had to cut back. And quite a few people were left the lab. I don't think they really had to lay anybody off directly. It was just people left because they thought there was no future in it. And these observations were being done by MacCready and
Ruby Payne Scott.
And Ruby Payne Scott. There were others involved for a while before I got there, doing the observations before they were collated. But I was sort of attached as the fourth member of that. To sort of help them with things. And so I'd had no real part. I did some of the observations on that first paper, but I really had no really significant part. That was at Collaroy, yes. Right. Most of that stuff was done at Collaroy. And when that first paper was in the works, a decision was made to sort of make Dover into a station to do future work.
Right.
And I was sort of put in charge with what little equipment design and things like that had to be done out at Dover.
Can you remember, as you saw it at that time, why the radio astronomy was chosen?
I don't think there was any real depth of thought about that, quite frankly, if you want me to be honest. But as I said, I was not privy to the...
Well, that's what I mean, but something may have been told you anyway, but you don't remember even anything...
The people were looking around to protect the job. The sort of things that you see here in this country with large laboratories now, like what will we do with JPL, what will we do looking at transport problems and things like that. And I think the biggest mistake you can usually make is to try and retread a laboratory which has been, or a large laboratory which has been specifically organized to solve another problem. Yeah. It usually doesn't work. In this case, it just happened that it came off.
Yeah.
So it was just one of those things.
Okay.
And maybe you can say Joe had great insight in doing it, or maybe you can say it was luck. I don't really have an opinion on it.
Okay.
And I can't judge.
So you did help with some of those very first...
Right, but I was... This is solar observations. There was four of us, and then I had the responsibility after that. Then things started to sort of... Well, Joe was always like this. He let people alone. You've heard this a lot of the time. So there was no specific assignment, and that suited me because I had this tendency to withdraw and wanting to work by myself. And I was sort of... left out of Dover with no particular supervision at all. And then the report of Hay Parsons and Phillips came up, of course, and Lindsay McCready and Don Yadsley went out to try and make the first observations.
Of Cygnus A.
Mm-hmm. And they tried for about 3 months and didn't get anything. And then they went away.
Now, what were they using to...
They used one of the receivers we commonly use were the old gun laying, what we call the English gun laying, 75 megahertz receivers. And they were using, I can't remember the antenna that they used. As a matter of fact, they worked in the hut behind me. They came out really, I think they spent about two or three nights in one spasm, and then they came back and spent about another four nights and said there was nothing to it. And then it was dropped and forgotten, and I was left more and more alone, except I was doing routine solar observations, and I think in that series I saw some of the first polarized bursts and things like that, but I can't remember chronologically the exact details.
But you never published anything.
And that stuff was not published, so it's not really significant in the story, so forget it.
Well, no, that's not true. I mean, I'm trying to find out things that are not in the written record. Were you doing this just by yourself?
Yes, I was more or less left by myself. So then I thought one day, the story that D.F. Martin suggested looking at Cygnus, I can't really confirm that or deny it. I really don't know. It seemed a reasonable thing to do, but it has been suggested that he was out looking at Dover and suggested that we have another look at Cygnus. I don't really honestly know whether he did or not, but I know I looked at it again by myself. I thought, well, hell, I'll have another look and see, and lo and behold, I got interference patterns.
Is that the same technique that the
Lloyd's
Yadsley?
Mirror. It was the Lloyd's mirror, yeah, exactly
they were
the same
to use?
One. Well, I worked over the receivers and got the sensitivity up and built a new Yagi and things like that.
And, so that was the difference, probably.
Yeah, I was left that much alone. And,
right.
So I got interference patterns.
Right.
And it was a cranky business at that time. It was, I suppose, another week before I got them again. And Joe decided at that time that I shouldn't be left alone and I should have some more senior help, and I recruited John, and John came in. Well, I had no resentment or feeling about that. I liked John and I worked well with him, and it was actually a necessary decision. And so that's how
right.
we started again.
Okay, now let me just ask. So the technique to find the source in the very beginning was to look for fringes rather than to look for fluctuations. I mean,
well, the point was,
the way that it
point,
had been found.
Point was, yes. Well, the point was to look for fringes. That was the whole thing.
Yeah.
We had the whole argument in essence was if Hay Parsons and Phillips saw scintillations, it must be something very small.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, we have a device for seeing things which are very small.
Right. But in fact, it was, of course, as soon as you had fringes, it was a very interesting result that you had confirmed that it was small.
Right. It was an extremely exciting result,
right.
was the whole thing. It was to the people, to all of us concerned, I think it was almost unbelievable.
Right, but in fact, I don't believe that you did send off any letter to Nature saying...
No.
Why that? Why not?
I really don't know. I think that paper we published, I think, there was this business about which journal. It was published in the Australian Journal of Physics. It was decided, let's make a big splash and get the Australian Journal of Physics off to a big start. And it was published in the first issue of the Australian Journal of Physics.
That's the 1948 article.
Yes, right.
But what
it took a long time.
It took a long time.
It took a long time to tie it down. This was, I'd been at Radio Physics, it must have been Ryle. I always remember, if you want to pin the date down exactly, you can do it this way. Ryle started 6 months after us. That was sort
looking
of,
at radio
right,
sources.
Right. That was always a sore point. You know, it seemed important at the time. It seems quite trivial now.
Yeah.
And he got excited about it. And
I think that was late 47 when he began, something like that.
Right. Yeah. It was the middle of 47 then, because it means that it was the fringes were seen towards the end of 46.
Yeah, because Ryland Smith on Cass A is 48 nature.
Yeah. Yeah.
That must have been very soon after
right.
they began.
It was a 6 month span between when he actually started. So it was at the end of 46, which ties in with my chronology roughly of what I how I went into the radio.
But it still seems curious to me because the radio physics group was not immune to sending off things to nature about interesting new discoveries.
Well, one reason was my position. Don't forget that. Don't forget what my position was. I was a very junior one, and that there was some degree of disbelief that the thing had actually occurred.
Okay, okay, yes, right.
And, for example, after John came, this occurred. It was still after John joined me, which was only a few months after I'd seen it the first time. We had an expedition up to... that headland behind Barrenjoey, I can't think of it, which is in the middle of the Hawkesbury there, but again, we were still looking, it was John's idea that we should have a northerly looking site so that we could get a better angle on Cygnus to see it rise and
right.
set. But he didn't realize at the time that the land was too close on the other side, but you still saw fringes there. But we had an expedition up there, a gasoline generator, you know, and a Yagi and a receiver, and got the thing going. And Joe made a special trip up about 10 o'clock at night. Cygnus was rising late at the night, so you can work out what day it was.
Right.
And the thing didn't work. No fringes came up, and Joe went to bed with flu for about a week after it. So, or 2 weeks, I forget now. But it was, I suppose... one record in three, one record in four, one try in four, you might see the thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it was sort of a very shaky sort of thing. But as it got...
must have been early summer, by the way.
Yeah, right.
Or not early winter in Australia.
As the thing got better and better established, of course, John and I sort of went into somewhat friendly competition about what we... who saw what first. We hadn't started to work out how we calculated. We could work out light ascensions pretty accurately, of course. Not too accurately, because we had the problem of refraction over the ocean.
But more accurately than Dex, anyway, yeah.
Well, we didn't know how to work out Dex. I mean, we spent about 3 months arguing between us and about exactly how you solved the darn equations. And John, of course, came up with the final correct answer on how things were done. But neither of us knew any astronomy.
Yeah. Well, in fact, do I have it correct? I remember John Bolton saying that on this New Zealand expedition, or maybe it was at Dover Heights, he just read Apje. Years and years of Apje.
He probably did. He was like that. John was originally trained as a mathematician, too. But
How did you learn your astronomy?
I just picked it up along the way, the same as he did. Maybe he was exaggerating. John was not prone. he did exaggerate sometimes, but... now I come to think of it, I really can't believe he read years and years of Apje.
I think that, my memory may be wrong.
There was a classic mistake, you know, in the Cygnus paper. Again, the difficulty in getting it published. Here we were doing proper astronomy now.
Yeah.
Radio physics didn't know how to handle it.
Right.
Who read it? Arthur Higgs read it, and he was great because he did have an astronomy background. And Arthur, you talked to Arthur, of course.
Well, no, I never did talk to him, but I've heard about.
He died too, didn't he?
Well, no, I just never got over to talk to him.
You should have, because Arthur was one of the most objective people. Chris comes close to being as objective as Arthur, although Chris gets emotional too at times. But Arthur was objective. He was one of the greatest strengths to the early radio astronomy group because he had the ability to he had the ability to constructively criticize papers.
That's a difficult
asset, you know, to acquire, because most people tend to read a paper and think, well, gee, I'm supposed to be smart. I'm reading this paper. I've got to pick on something and show that I'm smart.
Right.
And so they read one page or something like that and criticize it to bits and send it back. Arthur was not like that. Arthur was very good. He was, I think, in my opinion, he was responsible for the quality of a lot of the early stuff. Everything went through Arthur's hands.
Did it not also go through Plausi's?
Joe would not. Joe was more inspirational in that sort of thing. Yeah, sure, Joe would look at it. And Joe was not as good as Arthur.
As far as that goes, Bowen also. I mean, I have found in the archives all kinds of correspondence back and forth about this paper's got to be rewritten, and it bounces back and forth, and it seems like it was coming from Pawsey and Bowen much more than Higgs in what I saw.
Well, Higgs probably didn't make the comments, but Higgs read everything.
Yeah.
Higgs read everything. I don't know about
that. He may have written those memos for all I know.
I would guess that that's very likely, my knowledge of the operation of the place.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know more about the
90s. But anyhow, I was going to say the final kicker on this was that the mistake in it was that they decided to send it to Harley Wood, who was an astronomer to New South Wales. And he looked at it and said, have you allowed for precession? Well, we'd never heard of precession at that time. So it didn't really matter because it wasn't very accurate.
But that got caught before it was published.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
But there was one other little bit in history which I should trace my steps back a little bit because it occurred with Lindsay. I probably made the first contact with Stromer. This is before the C.W. Allen business. I went up with Lindsay to Stromwell. I drove up because it was then, of course, the Commonwealth Solar Observatory.
Right.
And that we did talk about installing something up there, but my memory does not. If it was installed, I didn't do it.
You talked with whom?
We talked with Woolley.
Mm-hmm.
But there was no. He didn't dispute. Of course, there was radio noise from the sun.
Yeah.
He was quite excited about that. But whether it was done or not, I don't know. The only thing I clearly remember is the installation of the 4 Yagi array at 200 megahertz at Stromer. Now, the guy I've been trying to think of, the man I worked with on that, he was a young guy, and he was a very beautiful guy, and he helped me a heck of a lot in my early microwave stuff. But I did some experiments with him out at North Head at the Army Station out there, using the old TPS-3 antenna. I remember those distinctly because somebody wanted to give a short talk on radio astronomy or about the discovery on the sun. It was in the Times when he was excited, and they said, "Will you sweep an antenna through the sun for us and give us the sound as you go through the sun?" Well, of course you can't hear very much when you go through the sun, so we had one of those old wire recorders. I said, "The heck with it." I said, "They don't know the difference." So I just turned up the gain and turned
it. Right.
I can't think of that man's name because I went up, as I said, to him with him to Stromlo when we installed the C.W. Allen antennas. But Ted McCarthy, I mentioned Ted McCarthy and Don Urquhart. The group, really, the first expansion of the group, I'm backtracking again. Don Yabsley just came in for a little while at that time on that experiment to detect Cygnus. And why he was brought in by Lindsay, I don't know at that time. It was just Don expressing interest or something like that. But Ted McCarthy and Don Urquhart